Without further ado, I'm going to get John Hight up. John is a return visitor from last year, associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, author of The Happiness Hypothesis, and the new and intriguingly titled book, forthcoming book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. John Hight.
Thank you, Roger. So as Roger said earlier, this is a kind of a dinner party, and so far we've, I suppose, been enjoying the fare, enjoying the conversations. But what we read in the invitation and the announcement and a few comments from this morning suggest that it's supposed to be a working dinner as well. So I thought that my specific suggestion would at least be a suggestion of, if we're going to do this work, if we scientists are going to be suggesting candles or suggesting specific initiatives or things to do or ways to change the world, there are some cautions we should observe. We have relatively little moral diversity in science. We are overwhelmingly liberal. And it then becomes quite risky for us to generalize from our research to the public sphere. There are some things we know from moral psychology that can at least help. So that's what I'll be talking about today. So if we're talking about morality, let's start with some definitions. What is it that we're talking about? This is a definition from a philosopher in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Morality is an informal public system applying to all rational persons, governing behavior that affects others and has the lessening of evil or harm as its goal. It should resonate with most of you. What else could morality be except a way of preventing harm and promoting the care and protection of people? Here's a very similar definition from Sam Harris in something he wrote very recently, but it harkens back to definitions he's given in his books, that morality is morality is a system of thinking about and maximizing the well-being of conscious creatures like ourselves, many people's moral concerns are frankly immoral. Now, I'm not at all putting this up to then criticize it. This is my, speaking as a human being, this is my morality too. I am more or less a utilitarian consequentialist, especially when it comes to public policy. I think that our laws and procedures and should do what they can to minimize harm and promote human welfare. So I am not in any way criticizing this or even disagreeing with it as a normative statement. But professionally, I'm a cultural psychologist and a social psychologist, and that means that my job is to figure out how morality works around the world. And if we, to do that, I need a descriptive definition. That is, I need a definition not of what I think is right or wrong, but of just descriptively, when you look around the world, what do people think is right or wrong? What is a definition of morality that human beings seem to go by? And this is the one that I've come up with from my cross-cultural work, that moral systems are interlocking sets of values, practices, institutions, and evolved psychological mechanisms that work together to suppress or regulate selfishness and make social life possible. The idea here is to take morality out of individual heads. It's not something we know or some skill we have. Morality is something that emerges from the interaction between our evolved minds and our culturally constructed physical and social environments. This is also a functional definition, a functional approach. It says that the purpose of morality, and again, this is just descriptively, the purpose for which it was designed by evolution, by which I mean both biological and cultural evolution, is to suppress or regulate selfishness and make it possible for societies to emerge. In that sense, my talk is a direct continuation of Peter Turchin's talk from earlier. Okay, so the puzzle that I'd like to raise is, again, very much the one that that Peter raised, this the amazing puzzle of large-scale cooperation. Human beings are very unusual, actually unique, in being able to cooperate in large groups of individuals that are not genetically related. Part of what's so interesting about our cooperativeness is that it's on a spectrum. We're not just blind cooperators. We're very good at dealing with situations where it's every man for himself. And now here, it looks like every man for himself, although of course in this case, it's a tomato fight in Spain, and these people are all cooperating in order to compete with each other. But of course, in many situations, we really do cooperate. But we don't just do well at that extreme. We also do very well at the other extreme, at the extreme of one for all for one. We are selective cooperators, but we can cooperate to extraordinary degrees. How is this possible? How did this happen? For a long time, there was a consensus that emerged beginning in the 1960s that human cooperation can be explained so parsimoniously just by these two beautiful, simple processes, kin selection brought to us by William Hamilton, and reciprocal altruism explained by Robert Trivers and then extended by some other people later on. And that's all we need is just these two. This consensus had a kind of almost a quasi-religious aspect to it, in that people who challenged it, people who tried to produce talk about other processes, were often treated as though they were committing a kind of a sacrilege. There was a real, almost emotional response, a rejection of people who tried to bring in other processes, particularly group selection, group level selection. The main people behind this consensus, people like Dawkins and Williams, all acknowledged that evolution works at multiple levels simultaneously. And that group level selection was possible in principle, but they just said that, look, if you look out at the world as it is, in practice, it essentially is zero. It essentially doesn't contribute. Okay, but in recent years, in the last 10 or so years, also as Peter alluded to, things have changed. The consensus has unraveled, and there is an increasing appreciation that natural selection really does work at multiple levels at the same time. And then the question is, what are the factors that make intergroup versus interindividual competition more or less important? The basic dynamic that's been recognized since Darwin is that group efforts, cooperative efforts, are always threatened by free riders, by people who reap the benefits of cooperation without making any contribution. This problem was thought to be fatal in the 60s. But what has now been realized, in part by people like Pete Richardson and Rob Boyd, is that culture is a solution to the free rider problem. Cultures are extremely good at solving free rider problems. Cultures come up with all kinds of mechanisms. We have abilities to gossip. We have institutions and practices that help us gossip efficiently. Text messaging and the internet nowadays, but the gossip has been around for quite a long time. All sorts of religious practices, legal practices, all sorts of institutions help us ferret out free riders and make free riding costly. And once free rider problems are solved, and this is true for any species or at any level, once free rider problems are solved and you create a new one-for-all, all-for-one dynamic, you then get a major transition in evolutionary history. Big changes happen because of the enormous gains from cooperation. So major transitions, this is work by Maynard Smith and Sathmary. Major transitions are not common. If you look around, you will rarely find one. But when they happen, they change the game. They change the world. So we don't really know exactly how life started, but at some point, bits of self-replicating proteins, or rather than competing with each other, found a way to create a one-for-all, all-for-one dynamic. That is, they formed into strands that replicated all for one, or not at all. And once DNA was formed and solved that problem, life, or prokaryotic life, exploded and was able to cover the world. Then some of these early prokaryotes found ways of cooperating. It's widely thought that eukaryotic cells that have a nucleus and mitochondria, that each of these were originally independent bacteria-like cells that found a way to cooperate. They replicate one for all for one. This is a very successful strategy to get that division of labor. So eukaryotic life flourished and changed the nature of life on Earth. And then some eukaryotic cells solved the problem of competing with each other, and ways were found to replicate all for one for all, that is, sexual reproduction. All the cells in the body have the exact same DNA, so they're all in it together, and we get multicellular organisms. And then some of these multicellular organisms found ways to reap the benefits of cooperation, again, by channeling reproduction through a single member. So they're all siblings. They all reproduce through the queen, which is essentially the ovary, not the brain, of the hive. And here, too, the strategy is so successful that bees and ants and wasps and termites and the other ultra-social insects cover the world, are by far the largest part of the biomass, certainly of the insect world. So very successful strategies. When these major transitions happen, they change the world. The same thing happened for humans, but in a very different way. And this is Peter's book is all about this process. But once humans found ways to cooperate, to bring large groups together that were not kin, they changed the world. They took it over. They defeated their neighbors. And now the race was on to find cultural mechanisms that were co-evolving with genetic mechanisms for increased cooperation. Darwin observed this process. Darwin wrote about it. Darwin certainly believed in multi-level selection. Here's a famous quote from him. That a tribe including many members who had patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, etc., such a tribe would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. At all times throughout the world, tribes have supplanted other tribes, and morality is one important element in their success. Morality, Darwin believed, solves the free rider problem. Groups that are able to cultivate morality in their members outcompete other groups, and we are their descendants. We are the people on Earth are hardly a random cross-section of the genes that were here and the cultural elements that were here 10,000 years ago. We are the descendants of the successful groups that were able to bind themselves together and spread. My project for the last 5 or so years has been to understand how it is that morality did this. What is it that we human beings have exactly that made it possible for us to cohere like this? What has evolution given us innately, and what have we done with it? Let me just say a brief word about innateness. This concept causes so much misunderstanding and so much moralistic misunderstanding. It's so interesting how people have such strong feelings about whether things are innate and it's important that they are, or no, that's somehow threatening if things are innate. Actually, innateness, when you look at it this way, this statement from Gary Marcus, a brain scientist at NYU, I find just illuminates everything and makes all the problems just melt away. Marcus points out that the initial organization of the brain does not really rely that much on experience. Nature provides a first draft, which experience then revises. Built-in does not mean unmalleable. It simply means organized in advance of experience. The genes create the first draft, but the nature of humanity is that we have experience expectant development. Our brains are heavily revised by development within a cultural setting. So we just want to know, what is in the first draft of the moral mind? It doesn't mean that everyone's the same. It doesn't mean we're robots or slaves to our genes. It just means that this can help explain why we find these eerie commonalities around the world, even as we find enormous variation. I don't have time to go into the procedure that I used to do this, but a colleague, Craig Joseph, and I, we read through literature in anthropology and in evolutionary psychology at the same time, looking for matches. We found what we think are the 5 best matches, which we call the 5 foundations of human morality. The first is issues of harm and care. We're all mammals. We are 2 different kinds of primates. It would be awfully hard to argue that maternal care, the love of our children, is something that was just some cultural construction foisted upon us in childhood by a gendered patriarchy or something like that. We heard today about Gandhi cells. We're learning ever more about the ways that our brains are wired up so that, boy, do we hurt when we see other people hurt, and and we are then often motivated to do something about it. So I think this is a very good candidate for being a foundation of human morality, which cultures then build on to variable degrees. When we see instances of violence, it's disturbing. It hurts to see this. The second foundation is fairness and reciprocity, absolutely universal in human societies. Turns out actually to be rather hard to find among animals. It's controversial, but the evidence is really not very good even in chimpanzees. But it is incontrovertible in humans, the golden rule, reciprocity. And when we see blatant cases of unfairness, of discrimination, it is also disturbing. Of course, we can do it too for other reasons, but there's something about it there's something in our minds that makes it easy for us to learn to respond to these specific instances. The third is in-group loyalty. Now, sociality and cooperation are common in the animal kingdom, but as with wolves, these groups are always very small and almost always closely related. Humans are unique in being able to cooperate in large groups that are unrelated. We love doing it so much that we do sports basically just to exercise our tribal minds. It's fun. And when we see people disrespecting those symbols that we cohere around, that we rally around, it triggers enormous amounts of anger in those people who have part of their morality built on this foundation. I should just say that of the first 2 foundations, the harm and the reciprocity, the harm and the fairness, Those are built on everywhere in the world. What I found in a lot of my work recently is that political liberals build their morality almost entirely on those two foundations. You get a little bit of liberal tribalism. But the first two foundations are the ones that liberals tend to focus on. Political conservatives focus on all five. So they're more likely to use this foundation. Here's the fourth foundation. Here are two displays of respect from closely related species. The ethology is somewhat similar. The experience is a little different. Humans, it's not so much based on fear. There's many more elements of love and admiration. But the ethology and the evolution, I believe, is at least somewhat similar. When we see blatant signs of disrespect, it often triggers anger. So many issues in the culture war are especially over the in-group, the authority, and then this next one, purity. This is a painting called The Allegory of Chastity. And many of us in academe are quite used to thinking, purity, that's this Christian thing that was long used to suppress women and treat them like property. That's really all purity is dominance of women. But that would be a mistake. Ideas and ideals about purity are very widespread, and I don't think the way to understand them is through power. I think it's more about the proper use of the human body and living in ways that seem consonant with our divine nature. So issues not just of sex, but of drug use. This is not a science article that you missed about the first human pig clone. This is actually a sculpture. But artists love to play with disgust and impurity, to revel sometimes in our animality, and that is also often deeply disturbing to people who have a purity-based morality. So far, it seems as though purity concerns are entirely the province of conservatives and the religious right. But actually, we're seeing quite a bit of moralism based on the purity of food. On the left, the left seems very tolerant of sexual issues, but really is beginning to moralize food and use sort of purity cognitions and, corporate food and things like that. So I think purity also is used by on the left and the right, although more so on the left, my research suggests. So I think these are the five foundations of morality. And if we now return to the problem of large-scale cooperation, the major transition, the central puzzle in, or one of the many puzzles, in how we became who we are, I think part of the answer is that traditional societies used every tool in the evolutionary toolbox to bind groups together. Owen asked about justice and cohesion. They do often conflict. But as Peter pointed out, a society that has at least procedural justice is able to get cooperation at a larger level, is able to regulate interactions within the group. So traditional societies use all five of these foundations. But what does it mean to be a liberal, at least in the United States right now? It means to reject the last three. Liberals say, celebrate diversity, not in-group identity. They say, question authority. And they say, keep your laws off my body. Sexuality, reproductive issues, drug use issues, all those things are entirely a matter for individuals. OK, so if you think about it in these terms, that there's this conflict over those three foundations, now I want to shift to what I hope is a timely concern for everyone, understanding both the culture war and the election that we're going through right now. America seems much more conservative than European nations. This is a puzzle to many people. But think about it in these terms. Think about it that in the way that any nation is a miracle from an evolutionary point of view. To create many out of one when they're not kin is a miracle. It's an astonishing feat. In the United States, it's even more astonishing. We're an enormous nation with enormous diversity, a short history. We don't have a shared religion. We don't have the soccer mania that holds so many European nations together. So E Pluribus Unum is our national motto, and it is a real challenge. And I think the way to understand why liberalism is such a dirty word, political liberalism took a turn towards social justice in the 60s and 70s. And since then, in particular, liberals are easily painted by Karl Rove and others. Liberals are easily painted as obstacles to the central magic trick of America. That is, liberals care about pluribus. They don't like unum. And they are obstacles to unum. And if you look at the sorts of many of the areas of the culture war are basically clashes between the left and the right over whether we should do things that will build coherence or not. We should focus on the rights of individuals regardless. If you understand it in those terms, now I think you can understand a lot of what happens on Fox News, a lot of what happens on conservative talk radio. constant invocations of how liberals are destroying the country, they're destroying the world, they're unraveling the moral fiber of our nation. Many of us listen to this to say, you know, what is this garbage? What is this nonsense? Oh, Ann Coulter, you know, has this book, Treason. The subtitle is Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism. Here's somebody even more extreme, Michael Savage. The subtitle of his book is Saving America from the Liberal Assault on Our Borders, Language, and Culture. From one of his radio broadcasts last summer, he developed this analogy that liberalism is, in essence, the HIV virus because it weakens the defense cells of a nation. He talked about how those defense cells are the military, the church, the police, parents. And he talks about how, well, you know, the military was just is being infected by the Nancy Pelosi virus. He develops this metaphor. It might sound rather extreme to us. Most Americans wouldn't accept it consciously. But intuitively, it does actually make sense. In terms of metaphorical mapping, it actually works pretty well, given what I've told you here about this perspective on the difficulty of creating cohesion. So I think it's really important for secular liberals to understand why it is that people on the right are often so hostile to us. I just want to point out that if you look at it this way, I think this helps explain why it is that Democrats do quite well in Congress. Americans are quite happy to vote for Democrats in Congress, but they don't vote for Democrats for president very much. In fact, only once since Roosevelt has a Democrat gotten more than 50.5% of the presidential vote. Congress is a dirty business. Congress is not a religious position. The presidency is a quasi-sacred, quasi-religious position. He is the chief magician charged with creating E Pluribus Unum. If you think about it that way, who would you rather vote for? Think about E Pluribus Unum. Here are two things I copied off the web yesterday. Which one matches? So, in summary, what I've said here is that human evolution and human history reflect the constant struggle to solve free rider problems and create Unum out of Pluribus. I've said, as Peter said earlier, that religion and traditional or five foundation morality are sacred to many because they perform this magic trick, and that secular liberals often commit sacrilege without knowing it, without intending it, with the best of motives, with social justice motives. But they do things like, you know, endorse bilingualism that are, in a sense, going right to the what little DNA there is in America and saying, no, let's get rid of that DNA. Let's let all the languages flourish. English should not be the official language. So liberals often do this without knowing it. There's a risk that scientists will do this also. In fact, scientists also are perceived to be doing it, and that's part of what's happened as science has gotten identified with the left and the one side in the culture war. So here's my candle. My candle is to use moral psychology when lighting other candles, by which I mean beware of our own moral tribalism and Manichaeism. Manichaeism, seeing the world as a battle of the forces of light versus the forces of darkness. So when Naomi, I think it was, who questioned the metaphor for this whole meeting, in terms of light versus darkness, I agree. It is a risky mapping, it is an offensive mapping to many people, and it is a self-righteous mapping. It's not just that we are smart and they are dumb, it is that we are the forces of goodness and they are the forces of evil. Secondly, and related, beware of tribal dynamics. Given that everybody thinks that the forces of light, the way to get a good, long-running, nasty, vicious war going is to say you're with us or against us. If you make inflammatory statements on one side, you're just simply going to strengthen the resolve and the recruiting abilities of the other. This is certainly the central mistake that the Bush administration has made, even in calling it the war on terror, a very foolish thing to do. And the last is to be humble. The other side is surely right about some things. If I had to bet on any issue, yeah, I'm going to bet on the science side. But would I bet that we bat 1,000, that we're always right? Of course not. We're wrong on some things, especially when we try to go from our labs into public policy recommendations. We're going to be wrong sometimes. So some moral humility, some scientific humility, I think will carry us a long way. Thank you.